Hello, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris Radio. I'm Lou Miranda. Today I'll be reading from the AARP Magazine for the April-May 2020 edition. The first article is titled, A Legacy of Love and Fire, and it's written by Christian Gregory. For most of my life, I've wanted to be my dad's wingman, and not just because I was his son. I was also a fan of how he lived his life and inspired folks. Dick Gregory kept reinventing himself. He was a college athlete, a soldier, a comedian, an activist, a nutritionist, a social critic, and in everything he did, there was a lesson. I saw him as a master teacher. Since his death in 2017, one of the great joys of my life has been able to tell the totality of his story. He often warmed up the crowd for Martin Luther King Jr. at civil rights rallies, for example. He'd be out there in front of the people who were about to stare hatred in the face and put their lives on the line. And to see them leaning on him, one another, in laughter, that was a testament to my dad's gift. But he wasn't telling jokes for the sake of telling jokes. He was agitating. About race. About racism. When he ran for president as a write-in candidate in 1968, it wasn't a lark. It was a challenge to the two-party system. Yet, as crazy as it sounds, my dad's work in nutrition is where I say he had the biggest impact. If I had a dollar for every person who had told me, I became a vegan because of your father's book, I'd be rich. I'm certain that's what made me become a chiropractor. He taught my 9 brothers and sisters and me how to eat to live instead of how to live to eat. No wonder a tall glass of carrot juice tastes better to me on a hot day than a milkshake. My dad knew that the change you make in your own behavior can be the most far-reaching of all. That's why I've been devoting a lot of my time to furthering my dad's legacy, to showing the full spectrum of his life. I'm planning to re-release one of his books and converting his lectures into print books and audiobooks. There's a one-man play the actor Joe Morton did about my father's life called Turn Me Loose, co-produced by John Legend. And then there's a documentary, The One and Only Dick Gregory, based on 1,200 hours of archival footage of my dad speaking in his own voice. Personally, I'm inspired by the message of selflessness that comes through all his works. It's a message rooted in love. It's a message that says all of us can do more. I'm almost 50 now and exciting getting a chance to use the lessons that enlightened me to help enlighten others. That is by Christian Gregory, who's 49 and a chiropractor based in Washington, D.C. The next article reads, Ahead for Show Business. In a legendary Hollywood costume shop, Eddie Marks fosters a sense of connection. My dad was a costumer. And one of my sons is a costumer. And here I am, right in the middle. At first, I worked on movie sets, but that involved a lot of travel. So in 1989, I joined the famous Hollywood costume house, Western Costume. I wasn't sure if I was going to enjoy it, but I'm still here, 31 years later. My role as president involves growing and safeguarding a vast, precious inventory. It includes chainmail worn by Errol Flynn in The Adventures of Robin Hood, Kirk Douglas's loincloth from Spartacus, and the red jacket Marilyn Monroe wore in Niagara. Can you believe if you took all of our costumes and put them in the line, they would be 8 miles long? It has taken time to get to this point. The beginning was certainly challenging, but I've worked hard to transform the business into a one-stop shop that provides designers, craftspeople, stylists, and actors with everything they need, including a research library, a fabric store, and workshops for producing made-to-order clothing, hats, and shoes. What makes me most proud is that it's a welcoming space. My customers are my friends. They all come in here to work, and it's like this giant family. And as long as that's the case, I don't see myself stopping. And that's by Emmy Award winner Eddie Marks, who's 72. The next article is titled, The Guardian of the Gates, by retired firefighter Dale Flatt, brings forgotten cemeteries back to life. When you work as a firefighter, you have a strange schedule. Here in Austin, Texas, it's one day on and 2 days off. I've always liked old cemeteries, and on my days off, I started finding them. I spent most of the year 2000 documenting an old slave cemetery. It was 3 acres, all overgrown. I mowed it and mapped out all the plots by hand. Eventually, I connected with the Texas Historical Commission and the City Library and realized that in Travis County, we have more than 250 cemeteries. I tried to find all of them. The directions could be crazy. Sometimes the place you're looking for is in the middle of a subdivision. The art on the old stones tells a story. An unopened flower, for instance, means an uncomplicated life. I've seen countless lives cut short. Who will remember them? In 2004, I formed Save Austin Cemeteries. When I started, a contractor managed Austin's 5 public cemeteries. He applauded my passion for all the other ones, but asked, in 50 to 100 years, is it really going to matter? And I said, well, it matters today. Now, though, I've almost come around to his way of thinking. If it's a question of funding cemetery restoration or breakfast for school kids, by all means, give the kids breakfast. I will find a way. My wife and I are planning to be cremated. I'm going to buy some tiny plastic vials. I told my daughter, when you get my ashes, put a pinch of them in each of these things. I give her a list of cemeteries I've restored so she can go poke a hole in the ground and drop a vial in there. I'll be the guy watching the gates. And that was from Dale Flatt, 61, and he's retired from the Austin Fire Department in 2014. Next article is titled Trial Balloon. For Judge Judith Nakamura, there's nothing more relaxing than floating on air. In New Mexico, there's a big annual Albuquerque International Balloon Fiesta every October, and in 2003, some friends called to tell me they were coming into town for it. I offered them use of my car, then I decided to tag along. When we arrived, I saw a police officer who occasionally appeared in my court, and he invited me for a ride. I said, but my friends are here. He said, give them the keys. So I tossed him the car keys, jumped into the basket, and off we went. The next Monday, I got my student's pilot license. I was hooked. At the time, I was a trial court judge, and for every trial, there would be usually 2 outcomes. Either the state lost or the defense lost. Ballooning doesn't have harsh outcomes like that, where someone must be on the losing side. The eventual outcome in ballooning is a landing. It's a physical and mentally challenging sport that requires the pilot to participate in ongoing education to ensure safe flights. Now I own an 84,000 cubic foot hot air balloon that holds me and 2 passengers. I'm not a fan of heights, and there are times when my knees shake, but the enjoyment I get from the sport and the camaraderie of the crew help to overcome the shaking knees. There's absolute tranquility as you're moving with the wind over the landscape. It's exciting to see what's below. You're close enough to see the detail. Sound is amplified. When you're floating 100 feet above the ground, wildlife jumps out. In the desert, it might be coyotes or rabbits exploding from their hiding places. Over towns, you get waves and smiles from people as they see you passing by. As a pilot, you have a lot of responsibilities in order to get the balloon assembled and inflated, but once you're airborne, you have little control because the wind is going to take you where the wind is going to take you. You're at the mercy of the environment. Ballooning beats any carnival ride I've ever been on. It's a new adventure every single time. And that's by Judith Nakamura, who's 59 and is Chief Justice of the New Mexico Supreme Court. The next article is titled, Roll Out the Barrel. Home brewing brought Craig and Bridget Geiger together, and now it keeps them hopping. 25 years ago, I had no idea you could make beer at home. I was driving down the road with a friend and saw a home brew supply store. We basically slammed on the brakes, pulling to the parking lot and bought stuff. We made beer that same day. What started on the stovetop has grown to the point that I can't park my car in the garage anymore because of all the beer equipment. Bridget Geiger. I met Craig at his home brew club. I was interested in brewing and some people told me to go. And then Craig invited me over to learn how to brew on his system. I believe it was over a boil kettle that he said, I'd really like to kiss you. Craig, yeah, it's that kind of serendipitous because that evening I was trying to make the highest alcohol beer I've ever made and it ended up being our wedding beer after about a year and a half when it was starting to mellow. We call the beer Collision Course. I've still got some in the cellar now. Brigitte, I'm trying to get Craig to make a Vienna lager for his next beer. I'll probably make a crazy IPA. Craig, we can brew 2 batches at a time, so we'll make 20 gallons, usually on a Saturday or Sunday. Sometimes we do collaborations, but mostly she has her recipes and I have mine. I do push her to make the beers I like, and she does the same with me. Brigitte, when you are younger, you go to bars to socialize, but now we socialize by making beer. Friends come over to help or just watch us, but it's calm. There's no loud music and all that. Since I started brewing, I've really moved toward caring about a craft and not only related to beer. I better appreciate the craftsmanship that goes into creating all sorts of things. Craig, you learned that it's a quality over quantity. Brigitte, Another thing I've learned is that some of these stronger beers definitely improve with time. Greg, they mellow out and develop a lot of character. How's that for a metaphor for aging? And that article is by Craig Geiger, 54, an engineering manager, and Brigitte Geiger, 54, a sales manager, and they live in Highlands Ranch, Colorado. The next article is titled Poetry in Motion. Pulitzer Prize winner Rita Dove finds her true self on the dance floor. Tragedy is what led us to dance. In 1998, our house burned down. Fortunately, no one was hurt, but we lost almost everything we owned, precious keepsakes, valuable artwork, all our clothes. It was horrible. One neighbor decided that a group of us should attend a dinner dance. I didn't know any ballroom dances. I didn't have anything to wear, and I really wasn't in the mood. A friend told me to buy the dress and figure it out later. So I did. At the dance, people were waltzing, and I loved it. I said to my husband, Fred, let's do that. So we signed up for classes at a local dance studio. There I met a group of people who were entirely different from one another, but who spoke a common language. There were bricklayers, school teachers, scientists, and one professional poet, me. As we rebuilt our house, we built our dance skills, and we've been dancing ever since. It has been a continual joy. For the past few years, we've concentrated on the Argentine tango, compare it to the improvisational jazz. There are fewer prescribed moves than in some other dances. It's more like a call and response. You have to listen to your partner's body. Your legs are all tangled up together. It's fun. When I dance, something starts to bloom out. It's still me, but it's the me who usually is too shy to come out. I'm living in the moment, and the moment is full. I have no illusions of being a world-class dancer, but I know what it means to complete the line, to make a gesture look like it's part of a continuing arc that extends out into the room. A beautiful dance is like writing in the air, a spatial calligraphy. I will try to complete the line whenever I dance with Fred. It's an expression of love. And that was by Rita Dove, 67, a former U.S. poet laureate. She and her husband, German novelist Fred Weichbaum, 72, live in Charlottesville, Virginia. Now we're in the section titled Your AARP, Real Possibilities. The first article is Women and Alzheimer's. Women face a double challenge with Alzheimer's disease. They have a greater chance than men of developing it, and they are more likely than men to be caring for a loved one who has it. AARP, AARP Foundation, A. Barry Rand Fund, the Women's Alzheimer's Movement, which was founded by Maria Shriver, and a number of other organizations are focusing on finding solutions to those challenges in 2020. In February, the Global Council on Brain Health, a group brought together by AARP that includes dementia researchers, advocates, and policy experts, issued the Brain-Heart Connection, a report examining how sex-based differences in heart health can show up in the brain. It calls for research on issues such as how come statins may impact women's health differences than men. In AARP and Us Against Alzheimer's will co-sponsor in April a brain health partnership meeting about prevention with a focus on women. The gathering will set common goals for the reduction of U.S. dementia cases during the next several years. In May, AARP and the Women's Alzheimer's Movement will release its Time to Act, The Challenges of Alzheimer and the Dementia for Women. We will map out a strategy to improve women's brain health research and policies over the next decade. Go to aarp.org/disruptdementia for more details about AARP's work on Alzheimer's and dementia. Well, that's it for this installment of the magazine rack I've been reading from the April-May 2020 edition of AARP Magazine. I'm Lou Mirando, and so long until next time.